Chapter 19. When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses, then you shall set apart three cities for yourselves in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. You shall measure the distances and divide into three parts the area of that land that the Lord your God gives you as a possession, so that any manslayer can flee to them. And this is the provision for the manslayer, who by fleeing there may save his life. If anyone kills his neighbor unintentionally without having hated him in the past, as when someone goes into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down a tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes the neighbor so that he dies, he may flee to one of these cities and live. Lest the avenger of blood, in hot anger, pursue the manslayer and overtake him, because the way is long, and strike him fatally. Though the man did not deserve to die, since he had not hated his neighbor in the past. Therefore I command you, you shall set apart three cities. And if the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land that he promised to give to your fathers, provided you are careful to keep all his commandment which I command you today, by loving the Lord your God and by walking ever in his ways, then you shall add three cities to these three, lest innocent blood be shed in your land, and the Lord your God is giving you for an, that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, and so the guilt of bloodshed be upon you. But if anyone hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and attacks him and strikes him fatally so that he dies, and he flees into one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die. Your eye shall not pity him, but you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel so that it may be well with you. How do you break a cycle of self-perpetuating violence? It is certain, and I think it is fair to say, some of you have very violent tendencies. And this text offers release from the viciousness of family blood feuds, of human retaliation, of vigilante acts of one kind or another. The idea that a manslayer should become fair game for anyone who seeks to restore honor in lynching him or torturing him to death is not a distant echo of a barbaric past. It is unfortunate but true to say that our modern world hasn't evolved beyond such practices. They are still current. They're still very much one of the big problems of the human race, the world in which we live. Think of the sectarian killings of Northern Ireland that are finally inexplicable to outsiders like us. You look at this and you say, this is so pointless, this violence, this killing. But it happens. You think of the ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. That's not long ago. This is not even the Second World War. We're talking about the end of the 20th century. You think of the current ethnic cleansing in Central Africa. Or you think of the turning of the wheel of retaliation in the Middle East. You never know what will happen. What is certain is that something will happen. And these examples indicate that man's savage thirst for blood vengeance remains uncurbed. Give man the circumstances, give him the means, and he will satisfy his thirst for vengeance. Now, the appointment of cities of asylum, safe cities, safe places, as we read here in this text, in which the unintentional manslayer can't be harmed, is God's response to vicious cycles of killing in ancient Israel. Now, there was a reason for this law. God foresaw the reason, and so he provided cities like this. Before we go deeper, I feel It is necessary to point out that with chapter 19, in fact, with this very text, we enter into a new section of the Deuteronomic Law Code. Here at the beginning of chapter 19, we open a new chapter. And this chapter reaches all the way through chapter 22, verse 8. These are laws and statutes, all of them, in one way or another, concerned with the sixth commandment of the Decalogue. You shall not kill. Or I've also heard, you shan't kill. I like this. You shan't kill. But before we focus on manslaughter, by way of introduction, I'd like to place before you three general thoughts. Three thoughts. First, and this is nothing new to you, killing is not just face-to-face murder. As Jesus taught, killing is conceived in the heart. And for that reason, even an evil thought about your neighbor, even an evil word against or about your neighbor, is killing. You can destroy a person's life by destroying his or her reputation. And again, there is a difference between actually going out and killing someone and such things as destroying a person's reputation or thinking evil without a good reason for doing so. And yet Jesus emphasizes murder begins in the heart. And it is in essence the same thought that causes someone to kill another human being that also causes you to call another person a fool when you have no good reason for doing so. Murder begins in the heart, and it does not always need to result in actual killing. So, first thought is that killing is not just face-to-face murder, and killing can be more systemic also. You can, for example, remove the economic base of your neighbor or of a group of people. And when you take away people's land, the places of which they live, their income, you may be guilty not only of theft, but of killing. Second, these laws that we are about to study, they include killing not only of humans, but also of nature, animals and plants, in fact, plants also, because life in God's creation is precious. In every form it appears, and it must be protected. Yes, there are some life forms that are more worthy of protection because they are more valuable than others. But life, in essence, in principle, is worthy of protection because life comes from God's hand. Life is precious, and God's creation can't turn into a slaughterhouse. And third, and this follows from what I just said, the commandment, you shan't kill, is extended to imply its positive counterpart. This is also something that you are familiar with. You shall preserve life, or you shall act, you shall be proactive in protecting life from being killed. And this feature will confront us in particular in chapter 22. Well, here now our texts. Here we have this first section of this part of God's law to the people of Israel that focuses on killing, and this text is clearly defined with its focus on these cities of refuge. So imagine you are out there somewhere cutting wood with your granddaddy's oversized iron hatchet. It's a very, very precious instrument because in your days, few people even have heard of iron. Hardly anyone has an iron hatchet, but your granddaddy has one. Nobody knows how he came to it, but you had to swear three oaths just to borrow it from him. And here now you are, cutting wood in the forest. And the unthinkable happens, inconceivable. The iron becomes detached from the handle, and as you strike out for another crack at the wood, it comes flying off the handle and lands on the forehead of your neighbor, dies on the spot. It's a freak accident. It's the sort of thing that you thought could never happen. That's how it usually is, isn't it? You thought it couldn't happen, but now it has. And you are responsible for ending the life of another human being, and you will be preoccupied with remorse for the rest of your days. Although, however, you are, in that sense, you are responsible, you're not guilty of murder. And so God made provision to protect you from getting lynched from the seven violent brothers of the deceased. They go after you, and you must hurry to get to the city of refuge before they can get to you and kill you. But the city of refuge is a safe place. It's designed to prevent overindulgence or the overzealous execution of blood justice, blood vengeance. So then this text sets a humanitarian tone, doesn't it? Yeah, but there is no question of these measures arising from mere philanthropy. This teaching, this measure, is set in a theological context, and that's how it wants to be read. Take a look at verse 10 and then also verse 13. These two verses assert that this regulation is a matter of keeping the land free of innocent blood. Now remember, God lives in this land together with Israel. God is holy. And if the land is defiled, the land in which God agreed to localize his presence in a tangible way, that's unacceptable with God. He cannot live in a defiled land. So verse 10 applies this principle to the vengeful killing of the innocent manslayer. If he is killed, then the land will become defiled, guilty of bloodshed. Verse 13, in turn, envisions a case of cold-blooded murder. The murderer must be executed. He must be put to death, lest the guilt of the innocent victim's blood be upon Israel. Now, in both cases, the scenario is to be understood in terms of interrupting Israel's relationship with Yahweh. You see, we have learned from the teachings of Deuteronomy that the gift of this land of Canaan makes the land the locus, the sphere in which this relationship between God and his holy people is to unfold and to be cultivated. If this land, if the locus of this relationship becomes defiled, God can't live there and the people can't live there either. The foundation for this relationship then is like a carpet that is drawn away from under their feet. And so the land must be purged of innocent blood, in much the same way, by the way, that the land is to be purged from apostasy. To worship other gods in the land of God is unacceptable with God. He is a jealous God, and he will not hold the idolater guiltless. The land is defiled. It must be purged. God is holy, too holy to let this go. Defilement of the land by blood then causes a breach in Israel's relationship with God. It pollutes the earth. It's the quintessential, it's the archetype of a sin, namely to touch human life, which itself is grounded in the fact that humanity is created in the likeness of God. And if you kill a human being, as far as creatures are concerned, a human being who stands next to God, this is an assault on God himself, an assault on God, the Lord of the land, the Lord of the covenant, the Lord of life, the Lord of human life made in the image of God. That's how precious human lives are to God. And it is sometimes difficult to see this when you see what we do with our lives and how we mess things up. Take any one person that you despise in particular. Anyone, a drug addict, maybe an Adolf Hitler, maybe a homeless person. And you add all of the bad things to this. It's all their fault. It's all they're doing. And it may even be true. and you still have someone who is made in the likeness of God, what does that mean to you? It must mean something. Now, in this world, and you know this, in this world, even in ancient Israel, this holy land, human life is life at risk through destructive forces that pursue human life and expose human life. And so to have cities of asylum like these is to have a safe place. And this is essential. Listen, to have a safe place in this world is essential for a viable life under covenant with the God of life. In order to have covenant with God, you have to have a safe place. Anything less is unacceptable with God. So, in a general sense, let me begin by saying the theological underpinnings, the theological implications of these cities ask us to consider God. Consider God the ultimate safe place, and not only in ancient Israel, but in all of creation. Psalm 9:9 says, Yahweh is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in time of trouble. 57:1, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. 62:7, on God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in him at all times, O people, pour out your heart before him, God is our refuge. Now, these references could be multiplied at will, as you are used to saying, there's plenty more where this came from. But these three references, they may suffice us to illustrate the point that the cities of refuge, they must relate to God. They point to God as the ultimate safe place in creation. And this is what Psalm 46 is talking about, isn't it? It imagines the worst case scenario that could ever happen. I don't know whether you've ever experienced a real earthquake, a violent earthquake, in which the earth literally goes like this. And everything, even the ground on which you stand, everything that you used to take for granted is not so granted anymore. Psalm 46 talks about the heavens being dissolved and the earth giving way. Creation in a turmoil and being destroyed, utterly destroyed. And yet, we will not fear because God is our refuge. You have to have a safe place in this world. After all, the world will be destroyed. But more specifically, the cities are a portrait of Israel under the Old Covenant. The covenant that God made with Israel functions much like a city of refuge in these laws. From a distance, the cities of refuge perform two functions. One is obvious, it's the protection of the manslayer. So then, when you go to this city, although you've killed your neighbor unintentionally, you will be preserved in that city. You can't go out of that city. You stay there. If you don't stay there, you alone are responsible for your untimely death. But you are preserved in that city, in that safe place. At the same time, because you are confined to that city, you are also in exile. And you have to consider this. This is not a small thing. This is a profound change in the life of this person. Yesterday, the world seemed to be okay. Today, you are on the run from these seven violent brothers, of the man whom you have killed unintentionally, and you have to leave your family behind. And you have to go to the city of refuge. And you have to stay there for who knows how long. So then the fugitive can't go home, yeah? He can't farm his land, He can't bring in his harvest. He can't even live with his family, unless, of course, he's a wealthy man and he can afford to bring his family to the city of refuge. Very few people could have done this. This is profound stuff. It's very profound. So this is exile, really. He's in exile. Until the death of the high priest who ministers in his days. Now, our text doesn't mention this, but Numbers 35 gives a fuller account of this measure of the cities of refuge. And in that chapter 35:9 following, Moses teaches that this manslayer, the unintentional manslayer, is safe in the city until the day that the high priest dies. And on that day, he can pack up his stuff and go back home, and no one can harm him. He is to go home and he is to live there as he always used to as a free man, with his family, on his land. You see, in the Old Testament, it was so that as long as there was only one man alive, bearing the name of the clan to whom that parcel of land belonged, it could not be taken away. Now, it could be farmed by other people, but they would have to return it in the year of release. It had to be given to the person, to the owner, to the rightful clan, free of charge, no questions asked. So this land was reserved even for the manslayer so that he would eventually come to his inheritance. This is a picture of Israel. This is the picture of the people of God under the Old Covenant. What is the Old Covenant? From all that we have learned, only from these first 19 chapters or 18 chapters in Deuteronomy, the Old Covenant is both a means by which God preserves his people, and it is also the means by which God will send them into exile. Here is Israel living in Canaan. They do not become guilty. They have always been guilty. They've always worshipped other gods. They've always been guilty, and so one day they are being sent into exile. They lose possession of the land, and granted, they come back after some 70 years, but even after their return, it is everyone's clear understanding that Israel remains in exile. Why? Because they have no king. They are not a free people as they used to be. They are not a sovereign nation. They're ruled over by foreign kings. They pay taxes to foreign kings. They are, as Luke chapter 1 in the Song of Zechariah describes it, they are under oppression of foreigners, of enemies. They're in exile, even in their own land. And you see, this situation of Israel in exile on account of her guilt remains until the death of the high priest. The death of God's own Son, Jesus Christ. And when Jesus Christ died, God's people were released from exile and were brought back home. So the Old Covenant, although it exposes Israel's sins, although it implies exile, exile will come. It's not even a question of whether or not it will come. The Old Covenant is also the means by which God preserved the national life of Israel for a future redemption until the death of the high priest, until the fullness of time would come. The cities of refuge are pictures of Israel under the Old Covenant, confined, yes, but also preserved for something better, for a homecoming. Maybe Paul thought of the cities of refuge when he spoke of the Old Covenant as a kind of confinement or captivity, but also as a preservation for a salvation that we now have. Galatians 3:21. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? By no means. But the scriptures imprisoned everyone under sin, so that the promise of by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. Now, before faith came, listen, we were held captive under the law, imprisoned until the coming faith would be revealed. So then, the law was our guardian. A guardian until Christ came in order that we might be justified by faith. And now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. For in Christ Jesus, you are all sons of God through faith. There's no point in trying to compare one small detail with another. You have to look at the big picture. And the big picture is that on the one hand, Paul conceives the time of the old covenant, that is that time being under the law, as a confinement. He even calls it captivity. It's an exile. But on the other hand, he also affirms that it was a time of being guarded, being under a legal guardian. That's a time of being under preservation for something better, and he identifies this something better. It is justification, freedom from guilt, freedom from exile by faith in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So once again, Paul's construal of the old covenant in relation to the new bears striking resemblance with the arrangement for the cities of refuge in key areas. The cities were safe places, and they were places of confinement for a future release. And what do we gather from this? Christ has come. The death of the high priest has occurred. It has happened. And you are already on your way home. You have left this city of confinement and exile for something better. You're already on your way to your home, your heavenly inheritance that is reserved for you in the same way that the land was reserved for the manslayer in the city of refuge. It could never be taken away. God himself made sure it would be there when he would return. And the time of our guilt is past. As Paul says in Galatians 5:1, it's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Yeah, granted, you could say a whole lot more about God's salvific purposes, but the time of guilt is past. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free, as one of the contentions of the letter to the Galatians. Our freedom lies in the fact that in Christ, we have returned to our God, who is already our inheritance in this world, a safe place in this world. And we can live in such a way as we always should have, as free people, even in trouble sometimes. And when the weight of sin and guilt molests you, remember that your identity is not grounded in what you used to be or what you used to do, but in what you have become. What you are now and what you will become in Jesus Christ. Beloved, we are already children of God. That's what you are. And it hasn't yet appeared what you will be. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Praise to God, for he has broken the cycle of guilt and death and the judgment. And he has created a safe place for you, a sanctuary that goes with you wherever you are, whatever you do, a safe place. And you need this in order to cultivate the relationship that you have with God. So I want you to take this home with you. You have a safe place. There is a safe place. He has put you in a safe place forever in Jesus Christ. And not only this is very tangible. Paul says in Romans chapter 8 that in putting us in this safe place in Jesus Christ, God is drawing the line against any evil force that seeks to destroy us, undo us, or seeks to separate us from the love of God. No one will succeed. It's a safe place. Jesus Christ is your safe place. Know that you are in Him, and then remain in Him. Amen.